The Tropic of Dragon Slayers is a little difficult in the sense that it is not something that we can immediately relate to things around us because obviously there are no dragons around us. And thankfully, we don't have to be dragon slayers in the real, actual sense of being in the wild and facing dragons and vanquishing them. But we have to study this because this forms a part of this dragon slaying stories, forms a part of one of these archetypal myths. And when we say archetypal myths, what we mean is that some archetypal patterns, which can be found in various ways across cultures, climates, civilizations, and nations, right? So, dragon slaying is one such mythological archetype. Interestingly, in India, there is more of references, not more, plenty of references of Nagas and Sarpas and Sheshas and so on, which is basically serpents, rather than dragons. Dragon seems to be on the left and right of India. India seems to have chosen the symbology of serpent to represent the same truth, basically. Nevertheless, the archetypal pattern is seen very much in Indian mythological and even why mythological, even in Vedic literature also. Some of these other archetypal myths also we recognize, such as the return of the sun, right? The famous story is of that of the prodigal son in the Bible, right? But there is always this story of somebody who is from a good lineage but goes astray, giving up all the treasures that is there at home, right? Goes wandering and has a bad life, but comes back and recovers the treasure that was already there at home. Or it could be the story, a slight alteration of a separation between the lover and the beloved for some various reasons, and finally the union of the lover with the beloved, which is a heavily Sufi saturated theme, such as the moth merging in the fire or Laila and Majnu, which is seen romantically, but the Sufis have a different interpretation of it. So the return of the sun or the return of the beloved, the union of the beloved and lover, these all form one cluster of mythological archetypes. And the other is righteous war. Righteous war. The righteous war itself has two variations. One is righteous war in order to obtain a kingdom which belongs to a party or a person righteously. The rightful ownership of the kingdom belongs to a person or a party, and a war is waged in order to remove the usurpers or the one who has overtaken the kingdom, and the kingdom is conquered. Right? That is one aspect of righteous war. The other aspect of righteous war, and in the first aspect, we clearly see Mahabharata. Right? Mahabharata is one such story. The other aspect is what we find a variant in Ramayana, which is it is a rightful war waged in order to gain the beloved who has been stolen. In the earlier case, it is a kingdom which has been usurped and squatted upon. And in Ramayana, we find righteous war waged in order to find the beloved and retrieve the beloved. One is retrieval of kingdom, retrieval of the beloved, right? Variations. In fact, if you really come to think of it, in Ramayana, though India doesn't have dragons represented as such as we know it today, one really wonders whether Ravanasura, with his 10 heads, would not represent a dragon, right? With the kind of mythical, splendid creature that Ravana was, whether he is not a representation of a dragon who has to be slain, right? All these comes under a category which in the in And I don't know why mythologists use Greek term in, not Greek, German words to represent things. It's been a fashion since 1930s and 40s. They call it chaos camp, which means a battle against chaos, a combat myth, which represents struggle between two forces, one force which is representation of order. In the case of Ramayana, it is order because Maryada Purushottama is Rama, and he wants to establish order. And then there is the other party, which is chaos, darkness, confusion, unpredictability. And that has to be conquered, the darkness has to be dispelled, and order has to be established, right? So this is called as chaos camped, the battle against chaos, combat myth, widespread mythological motif involving battle between a cultural hero deity with a chaos monster, often in the form of a sea serpent or a dragon. So this is about a dragon or a monster or an evil person holding a captive and a hero saving, killing the dragon or killing the serpent or killing the monster and saving the beloved, saving the captive, right? Then there is another aspect of, see, here we find that a dragon or a serpent or a evil entity holding on to something which doesn't belong to it, right? Unrightfully holding on to it. On the other aspect, the diametric opposite of it is you find Sphinx. The symbology of Sphinx, where it's a mythical creature which guards, but only to evaluate. It is not holding something that doesn't rightfully belong to it, but it is a guardian. That's a different kind of category, where even in India, we find certain treasures or certain vidyas being guarded by certain entities, and they are evaluators. They are not guarding out of jealousy, but they are guarding in order to allow only those who are fit and those who have the capacity and those who have the moral moral development, authority, to pass into the precincts. Right? So that is a different, the Sphinx and those, the guardian things, that's a different thing altogether. Now, why do we have to study the myths at all is because it looks like fables and stories. I mean, we would tell the story of a dragon slaying to probably a child. But nevertheless, any symbol, story, even a tradition, living tradition, which has been started by occultists in its root, always have certain truths embedded in it, and those truths relate to the soul of man, right? And a correct study of symbology with occult light throws light upon so many things that mere scientific investigation of material things will never be able to give us that insight, inner insight, right? So that is the thing. So great truths have been passed on to us, and they are being encoded as stories and traditions and symbols. So it makes sense for us to, take this wisdom and study it, right? That's one thing. Especially dragons, right? Because that's the topic that we are considering, so we are focusing on dragons. Especially dragons have a reference to what is called as the astral world, and specifically what we will study today about astral light, right? There are multiple dragons spoken of, just as in India there are serpents which are wise and there are serpents which are harmful, poisonous, right? There are serpents which speaks and serpents which bites, right? So that differences, both are captured among dragon. But when we say dragon slayers, slaying of the dragon, we are referring to a lower form of a dragon, not the higher dragon, obviously, and the slaying of it is what we will consider. And this dragon understanding, or understanding of the inner world, basically understanding of the inner life of man, and what effect that does his thoughts and feelings have upon the world around him, the world in the sense, the invisible world, which interpenetrates all of us, that becomes a very important topic to study. Because if we subtract the inner from any consideration of morality, any consideration of right and wrong, good and evil, and what is to do, what is not to do, what is purity, what is impurity, right? If we subtract the inner from the outer and only consider things on the mundane plane, the terrestrial plane, we will be sure to be led wrong, and it will lead to one of the greatest mithyachara, hypocrisy, right? So the inner must be understood to determine what is right and what is wrong, right? So for man's self-purification and resolution of so many mysteries around us, the inner must be understood. And as we see somewhere beautifully mentioned in Isis or elsewhere, the inner impinges upon the outer. It is always present. It is only that man's eyes, ears are so coarse that they cannot see the working of miraculous things happening right in front of him. Right? Now, coming to dragon as a word, it seems that word dragon comes from the Greek drakon, drakentos, which means serpent. And it comes from a verb drakomai, which means I see, right? Referring to something which has a deadly glance. It seems dragons, just like in India, we find serpents having a deadly glance, right? Unusually bright or sharp eyes, because the eyes of the snake is said to be always open, and the eyes of the snake is said to have a sort of charismatic, hypnotizing influence on the bird or any of its prey, just like dragon is supposed to have such thing. And very interestingly, this deadly glance, I see and all, comes from a Sanskrit root. So dragon has a Sanskrit root ultimately, which comes from the root, the dhatu, drish, which means to see. So here we see the two seeing aspects, right? One is the aspect of seeing, which leads to wisdom, right? The eyes which see, and the various examples we'll consider. And then there is the other aspect of seeing which kills, the deadly glance, venomous glance, right? Firstly, the Shiva's glance towards Kama in mythology was something which sort of burnt Kama in order to purify him and bring out the higher aspect. That is Shiva's eye. That is also a glance, right? That's one thing. And secondly, we find in the Scandinavian mythology, Odin. Odin is supposed to have one eye. And how did he become one-eyed? In the Bible, it says, right, where, what is the verse says? When the eye is one, the body is full of light, right? So Odin has become one-eyed. The story goes, beautiful story, which says that there was a world tree, right? Yggdrasil, the mundane tree. And at the roots of it were certain characters, certain mysterious things written. And one who can read it had the power to understand, it would become omniscient, basically, right? Omniscient. And Odin had to sacrifice for that, Odin the god. And what he does is he plucks his one eye, sacrifices it in bargain, so to say, hangs himself upside down, drives a stake through his being, basically crucifies himself, right? And through that effort, he gazes with one eye, read the runes at the root of the tree, and then becomes omniscient, right? His one eye is supposed to be a glance which can, in one blink, understand the whole of the universe, right? That's another aspect, the divine, all-seeing eye of Odin. Then there is also the good serpents and their vision, especially among the sect of Nasenis, about whom we read in Isis Unveiled, right? It seems their every temple was called Naos, in the honor of the serpent. The serpent was called Nas, something close to Naga, right? Nas. And the temple itself was called Naos, which means the moist essence of the universe. Moist essence of the universe, without which not of all things exist, mortal or immortal, animate or inanimate. Nothing can be held together without that moist essence. Astral, Akasha, right? And furthermore, all things are subject to him. He is good and has all things in him, so that he distributes beauty and bloom to all that exist according to one's nature and peculiarity, as though permeating all. I mean, this appears like a verse from Bhagavata Purana describing Vasudeva. And, you know, there's such commonality between Nasinis, who were a Gnostic sect worshipping the serpent, and their version of deity, who permeates all and distributes everything equally and gives apportions to people what is just for them. And it was a wonderful thing. And G.R.S. Mead, it seems, comments on this. This is given in Wikipedia. He says, this is the cosmic Akasha of Upanishad, he says. And the Kundalini, the serpentine force in man, which when following animal impulse is the force of generation, but when applied to spiritual things, makes of man a god. Right? So in other words, just like the serpent moves in a serpentine fashion, zigzag fashion, the river also moves in a zigzag fashion, and river was representative of serpent, moist, river, water, these were all symbols. And it is the Mead says, it is the waters of the great Jordan, the river of the great Jordan, flowing downwards, the generation of man, flowing upwards, generation of God. The same river, depending on whether you expend the energy downwards, it becomes creation here. You expend the energy upwards, or as we will come later to the work of Eliphas Levi, who calls it the magnum opus, the great work. If you direct the energy upwards, then you create a god out of yourself, right? The Akasha Ganga, he says, Mead says, Akasha Ganga, heavenly Ganges of Purana. I mean, with all the Kumbh Mela that is going on in India, and dipping oneself in Ganga must be probably seen in the light of this, dipping one's mind in Akasha, the spiritual wisdom, buddhi, right? And the heavenly Nile of mystic Egypt. It seems Nile had similar interpretation in symbolism of Egypt. So these are all good aspects of the serpents, the dragons. These are all good serpents. We are not talking about slaying of those good serpents. That will be a very bad discussion. We are talking of slaying of another aspect of the serpent, which is the dragon or the serpents of evil. It seems MLR had told this a long time ago. I don't know, but it probably comes in Valmiki Ramayana, where it seems when Rama stood at the end, at the edge of the Indian peninsula and looked towards Lanka, a blazing light, a blinding light from the jewel of the crown of Ravana shone, and it was shining such that a blinding light was there. So Rama takes an arrow and smashes it, right? So that is mentioned. I don't know where it comes from, Valmiki Ramayana. So that is the blinding light which we read in the Voice of the Silence as the light which bewitches the senses, blinds the mind, and leaves the unwary an abandoned wreck, right? This is the charm, the seduction, the kind of attraction that our defects, our lower passions. Passions, the word coming from word passivity, leading to passion. This is the charm that it has upon those of us in our inner part of the mind. Our mind, how does it work? I mean, think about it. The desire for, let's say, a good food, some peculiar dish that we like, is not so much stored in the brain as much as in the tongue and in the organs which were used to consume that food, which is in the stomach and other places, right? It is in the cell memory, the invisible cell memory of that person, right? It is all stored there. The craving, desire is stored there, right? And then it seems these throw electrovital sparks, as if the blinding light of Ravana's crown jewel. Electrovital sparks are thrown in the field of the lower mind. We are looking there inwardly, right? And there we, as soon as it arises, we identify ourselves with that desire and give it force and vitality and energize it, and it consumes us. And it propels us to do things, and it is only after we have done, eaten or committed that mistake or given into the habit that we had resolved early in the morning to overcome. It is after we have given into it. We think and say, like Epimetheus, what happened? Where did all my resolve go? Where did all my thinking and will to overcome this defect, where did all that go? And it seems, even in the brain chemistry, this is seen, that the centers of control in the brain shuts down when a trigger for a habit is generated. And from that point to the completion of the habit and savoring of the final fruit, right? From trigger to the final fruit enjoyment, the control aspects of the brain have very less activity, has shut down. Very indicative of, it's not that the brain is controlling us. It is that the lower mind, the thinking, discriminative, buddhic, manasic aspect of mind has shut down and given into desire, kama, has become one with it, has become a slave to it, has been conquered by the dragon, right? Has been slain by the dragon and held captive. And it is only after the dragon, after it has sucked out all the vitality like a vampire from us, our goodness, our resolve, everything is destroyed. We have become spiritually bankrupt, morally bankrupt. Then it releases us and leaves the unwary and abandoned wreck. If those of us who have some defect to conquer do some self-examination, we will find this to be absolutely true. Whatever is the defect habit that we are trying to overcome, this is an experience that is there in us that we can attest for ourselves. This is glamour, right? This is the dragon which has to be overcome, right? This is the dragon which has to be overcome. And here we see another important aspect we have to consider this. That is that all our thoughts and feelings, sentiments, what we consider as too private to ourselves, which is not expressed through words, nor expressed through actions, but which forms our real being, right? Which Guru Nanak says, your purity lies there. It is that inner aspect which is to be purified. And he says, taking bath in 78 kinds of Tirthakshetras, is not going to remove one speck of impurity from that inner being. That inner being is to be purified, right? So that inner being is constantly in interaction with his environment. That is, my inner being is constantly interacting with the inner being of all around here and with the general atmosphere, which makes simple sense, right? I mean, even physically, we find that if we are in the midst of people who are infected, we catch infection. It's a simple question of immunity and a viral load in the environment and so on. And if I am coughing and I go towards a healthy person, I will infect him. Similarly, my thoughts and feelings are not localized. That's the point. These thoughts and feelings of mine becomes a common property of the world in which I live. Right? In other words, the faraway criminal or the terrorist whom I condemn sitting here in my puritanical view is, or maybe, or most probably is, affected by me in committing his crime, and I have a moral portion to in his crime. I have a moral what shall we call it? Moral responsibility in his or her crime, right? There are many people who are unusually sensitive, whose inner psychic immunity is very weak, who may be far greater, who may be far sooner and quicker affected by the inner atmosphere than others, right? And when they do a mistake, when they commit a sin or a crime, all of us who in the privacy of our bedroom or the drawing room have thought about evil thoughts, which has contributed as a psychic astral current, which has moved that person to commit that crime, I have a part in his crime, and I will be held responsible, and I will have to face the consequences of this. This is what Eliphas Levi says. You know, very interesting. He says this. The devil, he calls the astral light, which is the container, the magnifier, the container of all our thinking, thoughts and feelings. It's all there impressed on the inner plane. He calls this the great astral serpent or the devil, right? And such a great teaching he is giving to Christians especially. He says the devil, I am quoting from his work, The Doctrine and Ritual of Transcendental Magic, right? He says the devil is not an entity. Devil is not an entity. It is an errant force. It is an errant force, as the name signifies, an odic or magnetic current formed by a chain or circle of pernicious wills. Formed by a chain of or a circle of pernicious wills, this must create this evil spirit, which the Gospels call legion, and which forces into the sea a herd of swine. It seems the Gospels speak of the legion forcing swine into the sea. I don't know where it comes from, but he says this is another evangelical allegory showing how base natures can be driven headlong by the blind forces set in motion by error and sin. So the collective error and sin of all of us is adding into this errant force, which becomes, so to say, symbolically, or so to say, it is euhemerized into a devil, which affects people, drives them to commit sins. Who is driven to commit sin? He says, how base natures can be driven. There are so many lessons in just this one thing. One is that I am my brother's keeper, in the sense that I am contributing to that astral serpent, the dragon, by my baseness, by my defects. I am contributing defects to the degradation of the world. In other words, or flipping it upside down, if I control my lower nature, my elemental nature, right, to that extent, I have elevated the world. I have become a benefactor of the world. To that extent, I have helped the world in moral regeneration. The other day, in the last meeting, our friend was speaking about how it is actually what we do in our family life, in our house, confines of our house. That's where, are we practicing ethics or not, right? Instead of mere speaking. That's the crux of the matter, right? So By my self-regeneration, I help regeneration of the world. This is the actual meaning of slaying of the dragon, right? Slaying of the dragon. And how base natures can be driven headlong by the blind forces set in motion by error and sin. These blind forces set in motion by error and sin that we are all contributing is the dragon, right? And we find further Eliphaz Levi saying that he says the secret of the great work, the secret of magnum opus is this. The great work is, before all things, the creation of man by himself. Creation of man by himself. That is to say, the full and entire conquest of his faculties and his future. It is especially the perfect emancipation of his will. Perfect emancipation of his will. Currently, in all our cases, it is said that will is a slave of desire. It is moved by desire. But will, we have to, the task that we have to essay is understand that we are not the desires and separate oneself and use the will to overcome our lower nature, right? And this has been mentioned in many ways in various mythologies. One of them is how in the case of Hercules, right, in the Greek mythology, Hercules, one of the tasks, the 12 labors of Hercules was to steal the golden apples. Steal the golden apples from the garden of Hesperides. Hesperides. In just this one statement, so many truths are embedded. Steal the golden apple, but the tree is guarded by a dragon called Ledon. So Hercules has to slay Ledon in order to gain the apple, golden apple. That's one thing. Hesperides comes from the three sisters who used to take care of that garden, who were called as the sisters of the evening star. Evening star, sisters of the dusk, evening star. And they come from the word Hesperos, which means Venus. Venus. Evening star, Venus. Right? So in the realm of the lower mind, because what does Venus signify? The duality, right? Higher and the lower. Right? Morning star as well as evening star. Duality of Manas. In the realm of the lower mind, there is possibility of liberation. Golden apples. But it is guarded by the dragon of darkness, Ledon. Ledon has to be overcome. Plain and simple. And it seems, by the way, that whole golden apple tree, the seed for the tree, was given by Gaia to wife of Zeus, who planted it in the garden of Hesperides. And Gaia is the mother of Titans. Titans, referring to Kabiri, referring to Manaswins, Manasaputras. I mean, this connection is clearly made by one who has studied even a little bit of theosophy, right? And secondly, how does Hercules get the plan, the lay of the land and strategy in order to kill Ledon and gain the golden apple? He gets it from Prometheus. Again, reference to mind principle in man. And it is because he gained that knowledge from Prometheus, he liberates Prometheus and Prometheus becomes liberated. And on the other hand, Hercules gains the golden apple, right? So brilliant. And son of Prometheus. The prophecy is that when Prometheus was chained, your son will come and liberate you. Till then you have to suffer. and look at its representation in different worlds, different mythology, but the same truth represented in the Greek mythology of not even Greek, where what is it? It is probably Egyptian of Osiris and Horus. Osiris, the sun god, invincible, is actually overcome by Typhon. He's killed by Typhon. He's paralyzed. He cannot move. He's dead. Osiris represents Christos principle in us. Christos, Christ principle, Buddhimanas, cannot act directly on this plane. On this heterogeneous plane, our higher mind, though we are gods, it cannot act itself. So it is overtaken. Just like for Prometheus, though a god, is chained, right? But he has a son, Horus, and the same Typhon reincarnates again as Apep, the serpent. But Horus has the capacity to kill and strength to kill Apep. He vanquishes it. And the teacher adds a comment to this allegory and says, Horus is lower mind. Apophis is matter, chaos, without any light of spirit. Horus is lower mind. Higher mind cannot directly act on this plane at all. Therefore, it has to send its son, its agent, its efflux, lower mind, Horus, who has the power to kill Apophis. And how does he kill Apophis? Through, the allegory says, through sphere-wielding, dog-headed creatures, dog-headed gods, cynocephalus. Cynocephalus immediately brings to mind anybody who has studied symbolism of Hermes, Mercury, Sarama of Vedas. Sarama is the Devashuni, is the divine dog. And let's connect that to India, right? In Rig Veda, Sarama has a very peculiar role to play, where the cows of Angiras, Rishi, is stolen by Panis, Asuras, and hidden in a cave, mind you, in a mountain, in a cave, right? Cave should remind us of Plato's cave allegory, right? It is hidden in a cave. The cows are hidden in a cave. Indra, the god of thunder and rain, sends Sarama, the dog, in order to find where these cows have been hidden. And then she finds it and has a conversation with Panis, saying that no, the cows don't belong to you. The cows belong to Angiras. Angiras, why does Angiras need the cows? He needs to milk the cow. What does he do with the milk? The milk is offered as sacrifice for Ratha, for world order to be established and maintained. Sacrifice has to be done. If he doesn't do it, there is chaos, and therefore he needs the cow. But you have stolen the cow. Give it back. So Panis tries Sama, Dana, Beda, Danda, bribery, everything. Nothing works. Finally, Indra and others come and vanquish Panis, and the cows are liberated. Right? Again, dog-headed, Mercury, Hermes, Buddhi. That's the teaching here. And the same in Ramayana we find in different way, in different manner, where HBB says, Mercury is the minister of Isis and always next to her. Without Mercury, neither Isis nor Osiris can accomplish the great work. Similarly, she says, Rama cannot accomplish the great work without the monkey-headed god, Hanuman. Hanuman, Sarama, Mercury, Cynocephalus, all these play the same role in mythology, representing different things. In application to us, it is buddhic faculty and the power of the lower manas. So mind you, it's Osiris could not overcome darkness. Higher manas cannot overcome darkness on this heterogeneous plane. That's why it is us, the lower manas. I mean, we are the higher manas actually, but in body, who are we? In the quaternary, what is our, what do we represent? Lower manas, waking consciousness. This has to do the effort of overcoming darkness, right? And this overcoming of darkness, so many commonalities we find. Indra vanquishing Vritrasura, the serpent, right? Or Puranic Krishna fighting against Kalinga, Kalinga Sarpa. Or Thor, Scandinavian, overcoming Jormungandr, the world serpent, which tightly holds the earth and leaves out noxious fumes from his mouth, which makes everything in earth's atmosphere poisonous and cloudy. Astral light, representation of astral light, astral serpent. Jormungandr is astral serpent, which just as Krishna vanquishes Kalinga, Thor, the god of thunderbolt, also vanquishes Jormungandr from the lake in which he was hiding after a great war. And in the Hittite mythology, which is 1500 BC, where current Turkey is, they had Iluyanka, a serpentine dragon, which was slain by Tarhuns, which is also a, who is also a god of storm and sky. And Akkadian Lotan, who is a servant of the sea god, defeated by the storm god Baal, and the Greek god Zeus, who is also related to thunderbolt, overcoming serpent-like Typhon. Wherever you go, there seems to be something to do with storm god, lightning, Indra-like figure, overcoming darkness, serpent, and dragons. Right? So this is a common motif that you find, and anybody who even glances at this should wonder, how is it that so many different cultures are speaking of the one and the same thing, right? And finally, the representation, I mean, what does it mean to us in our day-to-day life, right? Mr. Judge mentions this in a small paragraph. We will read that and stop here. He says, as the brain mind is the receiver in the waking state, it has to be purified. The brain mind has to be purified from sense perception. That's where the dragon lies. In the sense perception is where the sense perception is saturated with astral light, right? That's where we have to function, and brain mind has to be purified from it, right? And the truest way to do this is by combining philosophy with the highest outward and inward virtue. That's the crux of the matter. That's how we overcome the dragon. And that's what Mercury represents. And that's what the various paraphernalia and the weapons that is used by mythological heroes and the support that they get in the beautiful stories, they all are representative of this simple truth. The truest way to purify the brain mind is by combining philosophy with highest outward and inward virtue. And then elsewhere he says, until men forget the material world, until men forget the material, they cannot rise above the self. Until they forget self, they cannot rise above the astral. All things that please as well as those that distress men are in and through the astral. Rise above both. That this inner struggle, this war to obtain Sita in us, which has been overcome, which has been captured by the demon serpentine monster within us. I mean, even geographically we find Ayodhya is above and Lanka is below, right? I mean, they could have as well selected Iran or something else. I mean, it's all symbolical, representative. And there is a small, thin bridge connecting a huge peninsula with a small land, which represents that your higher mind is so vast compared to the small lower quaternary that is there. But still there is darkness. And still it is in that small cave that the cows have been held captive. Sita has been held captive. And therefore waged the war. Bridge of Antashkaran waged the war. I mean, the more and more you think, the more and more philosophy is has been beautifully represented in these things. That's why, finally, we will end here. What was the highest duty when Bhishma was asked by Yudhishthira? Bhishma was lying on the bed of arrows. And then Yudhishthira remembers, oh, he is one of the wisest person. If he dies, whom will I ask questions? Whom will I learn philosophy from? So he quickly goes and asks a bunch of questions. He asks, what is the greatest dharma? And without hesitation, Bhishma says, dama, self-control, is dharma. Because it is through that, that purification of self and purification of the world, elevation of the world, rooted in that. So we'll stop here and consider any points.